Hello, and welcome to, let me see which one this is. One, two, three, four, five, six, the seventh Millennial 2016 Hangout. This one is with Matt Tate. So, Matt, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, MW. Thanks for having me on. It's a real honor to be having a chance to chat with you over this Christmas period, mate.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm sorry we haven't had a chance before.
Yeah, we had a little bit of a chat, didn't we, at the NPI event? And yeah, this is sort of our first official chat, I think.
Yeah, I think we'd spoken on Skype at least once before then, but yeah, this is our first public chat. So,
Yeah. Well, as way of an introduction for people who don't know me, I'm not someone who's particularly well known. I don't really promote myself. I haven't got a book that I'm trying to promote. I don't have a YouTube channel of my own. I don't really even have a project that I'm working on as such at the moment, although I do have one thing which we could talk about a little bit later. But for people who don't know who I am at all, I've been involved in nationalist politics in Britain for over 10 years. I was an active member of the BNP when the BNP was doing well between 2004 and 2010, approximately. I've stood for election at local and national level, so I'm very much a real person. My face and name are known, and I've been on the front line since I was a teenager.
right, that's very impressive. I mean, one of the things about the alt-right is that it is largely an online movement, and people are, well, safely ensconced behind avatars and pseudonyms. So it is, yeah, I mean, what you just described seems, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but it seems almost passé. But of course, it is a mode of, well, activism or behavior that we're going to have to get back into at some point. We're going to have to transition back to meat space, IRL.
Yeah, I apologize in advance for being 3D.
Okay.
I know it's a bit gross, but
So passé. All right. I didn't mean that in a disparaging way. I simply mean that what we're going through just now is an online revival of, well, what I would call white awareness, white self consciousness, and so on. But okay, so let's start by just talking about your impressions of 2016. What would you say are the events of most interest to you?
Well, I think everyone's probably going to know what those events are: Brexit and the election of Donald Trump. But I would say overall, 2016, in my experience, and I got involved in 2004, and I can honestly say that I did not see this year coming at all. I've always been very, very positive. Whenever I've given a speech or done anything, like a podcast, whatever, I've always been well known for being a white pilling kind of a guy. But I really didn't see. I would never have predicted this. I was never white pilled enough to have predicted this. And I can definitely tell you that I went to sleep on the night of the Brexit vote, fully expecting us to lose. And I turned my phone off of airplane mode in the morning, fully expecting to have nothing but a stream of
I was exactly
smug David Camerons and, all these horrible people being really smug. So.
yeah, I was exactly the same. I went to bed, and then I happened to wake up at like 3 in the morning or 3:30, and I thought, well, I may as well look at what the current result is, and it was just completely different. It looked like we were going to win,
Yeah.
and so I immediately started to hang out about it.
I can still barely believe it, to be honest. I mean, it was so out of the blue. But with Trump, I actually kind of saw that one coming. I can't really claim to be any kind of an oracle because I got the Brexit one wrong. But with Trump, as soon as he announced, I basically thought this guy's going to go all the way. It just seemed inevitable from the very beginning to me. And I actually made quite good I made some quite good money by putting down a couple of bets at strategic times with really good odds. So that was a good result.
I wasn't that confident. It did seem that for him to fail would not be in keeping with his campaign. Put it that way. It seemed like it would just be kind of weird because he's such a powerful, confident, incredibly confident figure, and so for such a figure to fail just doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah, that's true, really. I mean, Donald Trump's character, to imagine him losing is actually quite hard.
Yeah.
So from that point alone, it did seem inevitable. But what a champion. He faced down everything that was thrown against him. But I'll tell you the reason why I thought that he was going to win. I mean, Brexit, for a start, showed you what was in the air. There was a longing for change. And I've described, from my own experience of being on the street level, I've been down streets and knocked on every single person's door in the street and talked to them. So it kind of gives you a unique insight into what people are actually thinking and what is important to them. And I really knew that there was a huge untapped potential for change sitting there, in Britain at least. Excuse me. And I think that was pretty obviously present in America as well. It just needed the right person to come along and to tap that.
I'm interested when you say that there's an appetite for change in Britain, and you, as you've divined from speaking to people on the street, what would you say they want? What kind of change do they want in Britain?
I think if you ask them, they'd find it very difficult to put it into words. And that's why I think they need real leadership. But I think their instinctual sort of spiritual sense of what they want is to feel like they are in control of their own destiny again. I think it's become obvious to people all around the Western world that their governments do not represent them. And I don't think that's ever been more obvious than today. And I think it's been obvious for a while, but it's taken a certain amount of time for us to get organized enough and for the right kind of people to come along to actualize that potential. So the way I'd see it is there's just been this huge buildup of sort of static electricity, a kind of potential energy that's been sitting there. And it's needed some people like Nigel Farage and Donald Trump to come along to turn that from potential energy into real energy. And I think that is what's happened in 2016. But I really don't think I don't think we've begun to see the full transition of that potential energy just yet. So I think there's plenty more to come.
I do wonder when you say that I completely agree that people feel their governments don't represent them. You could say that's a result of globalization or globalism. But I also wonder, I wonder what other causes there are to that. I mean, is it just that we have an elite now that is so... Why do you think that's happened? Why do you think it is that the governments today don't represent the people?
That's a good question. I don't really know what the answer to that is. All I know is that is certainly the case. I suppose to a certain degree, the Conservative Party has always had a certain constituency. It's always looked after the business interests, the people who had assets. The Labour Party is the party in the 20th century who has always supposed to look after the interests in Britain of the people who don't have money. These people are the traditional working class people, and I suppose it's really been down primarily to the Labour Party completely selling out the interests of their original constituency in favour of this new kind of proletariat of minority groups from abroad. So you've got the immigrant communities and all kinds of minority communities which they've kind of invented. So I suppose you could see it rooted in the Labour Party, I would say. And I think the Conservative Party have, through universities, been driven into left-wing positions on social matters. And the Labour Party have increasingly been taken over by the same elite. And it's become a career opportunity. I suppose politics has become monetized. Politics is no longer really about demographic power or voting blocks so much as it is about money, and money buys influence within the Conservative Party and within the Labour Party, and also even more so in America in the Republican Party and the Democrats. Money talks.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was thinking, I think now we tend to forget the significance of, well, I say that simply because you never hear talk about it now, the 2008 expenses scandal in Britain, which I think there were several, the global financial crisis happened. And then just a few months later, the expenses scandal broke. And there was a real sense, In retrospect, I remember at the time I thought, this is going to be seismic. And, you know, I thought that this is surely going to have a profound effect on the public's view of politicians. Of course, it's funny how things just eventually get absorbed. You know, the yeah. shock is absorbed and people forget about it. But at that time, that moment, it was quite, it just seemed like such a betrayal, a massive betrayal. And I know that politicians have always had these, I don't even really care about the thing in itself. I'm quite happy for politicians to have some, you know, treats, some leeway. But it was the grotesque nature of it. The avarice, I think.
Yeah.
And how shameless they were about it. Yeah. And also, I mean, when you got things like Jackie Smith's husband using it to pay for a porn channel, that is just so low grade.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing just seemed to be, well, just so corrupt. And it really put, I think it was almost like the final nail in the coffin of New Labour, because as I recall, most of the politicians guilty of it were Labour. And, you know, by that time, I think people were ready to see New Labour for what it was.
Yeah.
And this was the sort of crowning evidence. And so that would be one thing. And then more recently, well, something like Rotherham, I think, was massive in its psychological effect. That, and what I mean by that is similar to the expenses scandal. You just had the sense that not only the government at the national level and the local level doesn't give a shit about the white working class. And because it's happy to let this stuff go on. It's happy to suppress reports and so on. And then the third thing would be the Brexit campaign. I mean, the contempt for ordinary people that was displayed. And at the Euro the Euro elections, when was that? Was that 2014? I can't remember if it was, I think it was 2014.
Yeah, you're right, it was.
That as well, but then especially with Brexit. Brexit was the most, I had never seen such biased media before the Brexit coverage. And then the Trump thing, the America eclipse, yeah. Even that just a few months later. So I think that there is I agree with you. These are the causes, I would say, of this, or rather these are the main symptoms of the detachment between the disconnect between the public and the British government. As for the causes, yeah. I think your analysis is correct. But then in America, it's another thing altogether. As it happens, I was actually just reading an essay or an article in Vox. I think this was linked on Facebook or something. And let me just read you this wee bit, if I can find it. Let's see. It was about coalition building. Let's see this. Here we go. Okay. For several decades, the mainstream political parties in the US and the UK really treated white working class people with enormous caution. From the left's perspective, they're cool with white working class people's protectionism, but their nativism causes big problems for their desire to build a broad coalition. From the right's perspective, they were fine with nativism, but they had big problems with the protectionism, and that undermined the coalition they wanted to build. So white working class people were left not necessarily dismissed, but they've received a lot of lip service from both political parties over the years, who were never truly prepared to go all in on the things they most cared about.
Yeah, that's well put.
Yeah, and in both cases, we've seen, well, the result of that has been Brexit in Britain and Trump in America.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that these issues that you've kind of listed are the most obvious examples of very public demonstrations of this alienation between our elites and our leaders. on the one hand, and the people who have been voting for them on the other. And that difference is probably at its highest point, really, with the Labour Party and the white working class in Britain, because the Labour Party is the open borders immigrant party who love the EU, but the white working class people who vote for them are completely the opposite.
Oh, yeah, it's comical.
But I suppose the reason that this hasn't translated into something more revolutionary is that at this stage, there hasn't really been a well-organized attempt to give them an alternative that is palatable. The BNP tried, and unfortunately, due to its own issues, it just wasn't a more palatable option for the majority of people in the country. And they've kind of gone by the wayside. We're now in an era where UKIP really are the only real alternative. And UKIP are in a position where Nigel Farage, who really was a one-man band, has stepped aside, and there is a new leader who isn't very well known at all, doesn't seem to be especially talented, but he does have an accent from Northern England, from a place which is a Labour stronghold. And I think that the opportunity for UKIP is to pivot away from their traditional voter base of conservative seats in the southeast of England who want more conservatism, and pivot towards these white working class communities who have been abandoned by the Labour Party, primarily in the north of England and in the Midlands. The only good thing I can say really about their new leader is that I think he is going to be quite appealing to that particular demographic. And
is this Paul Nuttall?
Yeah. So I think looking forward to 2017, I'm not sure what elections are coming up exactly, but I really think that UKIP are in an interesting place where, you know, if we were doing this hangout in a year's time, we might be talking about UKIP as having actualized a lot more of that potential energy which is out there.
Well, I'm sure we will do this hangout in a year's time.
I hope
we will. But the one thing that does, I mean, what do you think about this concept? While you were talking there about the Conservatives and Labour, I was thinking, I mean, it's true, but I've forgotten what the one I read earlier, I think his name was Justin Guest, what he was saying about the necessity for coalitions, and the right wants is kind of okay with nativism. I think he overstated that. I think the right is kind of okay with nativism, but it really doesn't like protectionism, whereas the left is okay, kind of okay with protectionism, although again I think that's overstated, because the left now is very globalist, and it despises nativism. So what you've got here is two parties, both of which will damage the white working class, I mean in serious ways. I mean, if we're going to get right down to it, they're either going to damage the white working class economically, and which means long-term psychological effects, or they're going to damage them genetically with mass immigration.
Yeah.
So these are very, very serious things. And what I wanted to ask you was, what do you think about this contention that you see nowadays, that left and right are becoming irrelevant, and it's really about the real choice that has to be made is between nationalism and globalism?
Yeah, I totally agree that is the way things are going. I really think that the true left and true right have kind of evaporated. They've kind of been taken over by money, and like we said before, that you know, money is our new politics. Power is where the money is, and therefore, Labour and the Conservative Party, the Republicans and the Democrats, have become so similar. We've got this kind of unholy blend of left-wing cultural Marxism on social policy, and then a kind of what would be called right-wing, but is in fact really a sort of centrist liberal approach to economics, which is just globalism and unrestricted capitalism. I think that people are beginning to identify that as an issue as between globalism and nationalism. And I don't think anyone has really voiced that until Donald Trump. I think it was a speech he gave in Florida where he really laid into globalism and advocated nationalism. And it's one of the best speeches I think I've ever heard. I don't think I could have said it any better myself if I'd tried 100 times.
I remember hearing about that speech and I was going to look it up and then I forgot to. So I've not seen that, but I remember people saying it was pivotal. It was around about, was it June or earlier than that this year?
It's hard to say. I can't remember, but I would imagine if you looked up Trump speeches in Florida, it would probably be the one that was the most viewed on YouTube or something. So I'm sure it'll be there.
I'll look it up. And what you said, this choice between nationalism and globalism first being articulated by Trump, I think that's right, because ironically, Nigel Farage isn't like that. He does value the nation state, but he's quite happy with Commonwealth mass immigration.
Yeah, I mean, you can read between some lines with people like Nigel Farage and UKIP. They've got to play a certain game. They're involved in politics, which is a very practical sport. So a lot of people would say that UKIP's choice of opposing immigration on the basis of primarily on Eastern European immigration into the country is just a clever way of being against immigration in general. And if that's the case, then it's worked very well because it's given them a kind of a shield against just being attacked as being petty Middle Englanders and racists. But do you really think that Nigel Farage and people in UKIP want to have mass immigration from Somalia and Uganda and other places like that? I really don't think so. Unfortunately, UKIP don't have any influence over our politics because they don't have any representation beyond Douglas Carswell. Out of 650 MPs, they have one. So they have almost zero influence over these matters. But the people who are going to be voting for UKIP in the future and who have voted for UKIP in the past, they are absolutely against immigration, whether it be from Poland or whether it be from Somalia or Nigeria.
So you're saying that the media is correct when it vilifies UKIP supporters as angry nativists?
I suppose to a certain degree. The media might be onto something with that one, because I can certainly say that the support base that UKIP have are people who are nationalists. They might not be as sophisticated in the way they express themselves as someone at an AMREN conference or something like that, but they are people who want the same kind of things that we do. They want to see their people put first in their own country. They want to see the protection of Britain as a British country with our culture and with our traditions and with our standards of behavior. And they want to feel like they are represented and that this country is for them, that it is their home, that they can have children and grandchildren in this place and that they will be passed on the kind of lives that they themselves have enjoyed. And they know that that isn't going to happen if the country gives up on Polish and Lithuanian immigration in favor of immigration from sub-Saharan Africa and the Muslim world. So, yeah, I have absolutely no doubt that that UKIP are heading in that direction. They are certainly nationalists and they are certainly anti-globalist, I think, in every way. But I don't think Nigel Farage or any UKIP person has ever come out and said that they are nationalists.
I don't think so. They've said that they're patriotic, and
it's the implicit explicit thing, isn't it? They are very implicitly nationalistic.
I've just realised while you were speaking, I've realised the irony of what I said when I said the media call UKIP supporters angry nativists. It's actually Douglas Carswell who used that phrase.
Oh, really? Their own MP. He's such a backstabber, that guy.
Yeah, he really is. I don't trust him at all. I know that there is a theory that he's basically a conservative plant in UKIP.
And I
suspect that's true.
Yeah, there's definitely looking at the result of his election, you could certainly say that it's been more trouble than it was worth.
Yeah, I agree. So what else should we move on to? That's been an interesting discussion there, but I'm not sure if there's anything else to say about it, because It is one of those things where I think it just has to develop now. It's very difficult to see where it's going to go. I think the Conservatives are... I think both parties, the main ones, are just so confused now. I mean, nobody really knows what Theresa May stands for, if she stands for anything. She might be another Tony Blair in the sense that sort of managerialist psychopath.
I suspect that's the case. Did I ever tell you that I actually have met Theresa May a couple of times?
No.
I met her in the capacity as the election agent for the BNP, because a friend of mine stood against her in the constituency of Maidenhead, which is quite local to where I live. So I was involved in that campaign twice, 4 years apart. And the candidates and I had to go to the hustings and the debates and stuff that happened between the candidates. And it's only polite for all the candidates to mingle and to have a chat and to shake hands and that kind of thing. And so Theresa May had to shake my hand on a couple of occasions while I was wearing my BNP rosette. And
I'm sorry that happened to you.
I know. Thank you. It was quite traumatizing. She pulled a face that made me think that she was going to throw up onto our hands while she shook my hand. So, yeah. I don't think she likes us.
No. I mean, there are various things I could moan about with her, but I don't trust her. And in fact, I think nobody trusts her. I think she's... And it's almost like Tony Blair, the way he was viewed at the very end of his tenure, just the sort of piece of shit that we're stuck with. But at least we're getting rid of him. With her, we've got how many years left? 4 years with her.
Not necessarily. Most prime ministers, when they take over, they seek their own mandate. So the bookies are basically betting that there is going to be a general election not that far in the future. David Cameron, I think, won his second election only in 2015.
Yeah.
We're 18 months in. So in theory, she could remain as prime minister for 3.5 years from today, approximately. But realistically, no, I don't think any prime minister has ever done that. They always seek their own mandate. And quite honestly, why wouldn't you seek your own mandate right now when you're so high above the next challenger? The Labour Party are utterly unelectable, and it will be a complete blackout for the Labour Party. They are going to do terribly with Comrade Corbyn in charge. So,
what I was going to say. You know, the Tories are, the Conservatives are confused. No, I mean, it's not just Theresa May. You know, what do the Conservatives stand for now? I have no idea.
No, I couldn't tell you either.
I don't know. But the Labour Party are just as bad, if not even worse, because they have quite marked ideological... and I'm not even going to go into it, because it's frankly boring, but there are the New Labour remnants, and then there are quite hardcore socialist elements, and then, there's the Zionist element. So there was a theory that whole thing that happened with Ken Livingstone about 6 months ago, was all to do with that. The Jewish element trying to wrest control back from the other sides of it.
Yeah.
It's all very baffling, frankly. I think it's one of those things where you have to sort of know it in depth, and why would you, you know?
I might be telling you stuff here that you already know, but for the sake of a lot of the listeners who will be from America, it's worth pointing out that the reason that the Labour Party has had such an issue recently is that they had a policy for a while where you could join the Labour Party as a member, I think, for £1. So hundreds of thousands of far left activists and union members and, you know, these proper lefty types joined the Labour Party and effectively took it over. So the more sort of...
established.
Yeah, the sort of Tony Blair-style Labour politicians kind of just got totally annihilated because of the numbers of real hardcore leftists that came into the party. They've closed the door now, but they've closed the door when the horse has already bolted. So no matter what they do, they just can't get rid of Comrade Corbyn, even though he's a complete disaster for the Labour Party.
That's hilarious. Of course,
yeah, it is kind of hilarious. Although it's not funny from another perspective, because the Conservative Party can effectively do anything to us and they will still win.
Yeah.
Like, it's quite worrying, because they could literally put any kind of law through Parliament that really screws us over, anything that their paymasters want, and the Labour Party are nowhere to be seen. They're just unelectable. So I think that's one of the reasons why Theresa May is making signals to the right and trying to sort of move the Conservative Party so that it reabsorbs a lot of the UKIP support, because I think they realise that the real danger to the Conservative Party is from UKIP, not from the Labour Party. So I think politically what Theresa May is doing makes very good sense. And that only adds to the idea that she's doing it from an opportunistic point of view.
Yes, indeed. In the same way that other, what I would call managerialist politicians such as Merkel and Blair have done similar things. I mean, it's not about it's not about ideology. It's about power. It's not even about principles. It's just policies. It doesn't matter. It's just a sort of hunger for having power and holding on to it.
Yeah, that's it. You could see them almost as a sports team or as a business. Operate in exactly the same way. They assess the market, and their policies are their products, and they put products onto the market that they know are going to be the thing that keeps them in power and gives more jobs to their people and gets more money for their pockets.
Mm. So what future do you see for the likes of UKIP?
Honestly, I think Nigel Farage is a massive loss to the UKIP. To UKIP,
yeah, he's a
fantastic character, and his notoriety has never been higher. With his associations with Trump, I would say that Nigel Farage has now sort of reached peak Farage. His stock price has never been higher. Let's put it that way. So the fact that he isn't the leader of UKIP is a massive disappointment. If he could have just had the balls to stay on as the leader and to take UKIP into this next phase, I really, really think UKIP could have done well. I think UKIP could have got a few dozen MPs elected into Parliament, and it could have made all the difference. This new guy, he's not really that charismatic. He's not going to appeal to people in the south of England like Nigel Farage did. But on the flip side, he probably will appeal more to people in the working class areas of northern England, where the real opportunity for UKIP lies. Nigel Farage, I think, being a sort of posh public schoolboy from the south of England, wasn't a natural fit for voters in places, say, like Rotherham and Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire and places like that.
Mm. Yeah, I wonder what is going to become of Nigel Farage. I've heard various rumours. But I think if he had stayed on, I'm interested in what you just said, if he had stayed on as leader and then the whole Trump thing happened, you think that would have been good for UKIP's electoral chances? But I'm surprised by that, because I don't think the British public like Donald Trump in general. Do you think that's untrue?
No, I totally agree with you. I don't think Trump translates well over here. But I don't think that really matters. I think that the British public will warm to Donald Trump to a certain degree, because he's no longer an incumbent seeking election, fighting battles. He's already won. He's now a winner. And I think that... if you say controversial things and people write articles about you that cast aspersions upon you, if you win, it kind of writes a lot of that stuff off. I think that in areas like these areas that UKIP have got a chance of winning in northern England, northern English towns and other places like that, I think that an association with a renegade character like Donald Trump wouldn't do them too much harm at all. I think that Donald Trump would be quite unpopular in a commuter belt area, let's say like Hertfordshire, near the areas of London where you get a lot of people who are quite snobby. But I think in these working class areas of northern England, I think a straight talking New York businessman would translate far better. So I actually think that Nigel Farage has probably made a career slip up here by stepping back from the leadership of UKIP in the wake of Brexit, probably not realizing quite what was going to happen in the following 6 months.
Yeah, I think that's true. Well, let's move on to, you wanted to talk about the alt-right in 2016.
Yeah, well, it's been the big thing, hasn't it? The emergence of the alt-right, and it's catapulting into the headlines. Looking back in my experience of being involved in party politics, I really have thought that the alt-right is a fantastic phenomenon. It's just flooded the cause with a lot of younger, tech-savvy guys who obviously came from places like 4chan and image boards like that via the Gamergate issues. And looking back and doing an analysis of why the BNP didn't do better, I think that one of the reasons was that there was a very narrow way in which you could get involved. You had to join a political party. You had to go to these meetings and sit in rooms and listen to people drone on about policies. And you had to stand for election and do all that kind of stuff. And that appeals to a certain group of people, but it certainly isn't a wide appeal. And I think it was really doing a disservice to the urgency and the great importance of the cause as we all know it. So I think that the alt-right, one of its strengths is that it can appeal to people outside of that party political paradigm. And it's given people a way of being involved without even having to leave their desk. Now, yeah. There's strengths and weaknesses in that, but the strength is that we've lowered the barrier to entry, which is what they would say in, a business talk. So the barrier to getting involved is that much lower. You can do so from the comfort of your own living room. You don't have to go to boring meetings where you may or may not have a good time. You can meet people and have fun. I think the fun of the alt-right is something which is of paramount importance. If you're not enjoying something, you're not going to give it a full effort, are you? I mean,
I agree.
I know what it's like to be slogging up and down streets in the snow. You know, I've done that. I've been up and down streets in the snow delivering leaflets with frozen cold fingers and, you know, having dogs attack you and all kinds of crap like that. And yeah, that has to be done.
That's a terrible thing to say about Theresa May.
yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of great things that have occurred in 2016, things that needed to happen. Now, of course, there are downsides to phenomena like the alt-right. I think probably you could see the Hailgate NPI media shitstorm as a kind of a clash of these two worlds, a clash of the trollish, ironic internet LARPing and fun, and sort of full frontal assault and being completely arrogant and unapologetic on the one hand, and then the real world, you know, responsible, grown up public PR face of a movement. And when you get those two worlds collide, you end up with a situation like we had in the fallout of MPI.
Yeah, and I think that we still don't really know what the fall. We still don't really know what effect it's going to have on the alt-right long term. It is a disconcerting, troubling thing. That's happened, and I don't like it. I mean, I really wish it hadn't happened, because I don't. Some people say there's no such thing as bad publicity. I think that is true if you have the resources to weather the effects of bad publicity. I don't think we do yet. I don't know what to say about it without becoming quite well. I think it's an extremely complex subject, because this is all about dynamics.
Yeah.
And there are so many variables involved, so you can't predict it. One thing is that what would Trump do in a similar situation? He would just, whatever was written about it, he would just write over that. He would just storm through. He would just steamroll. He would refuse to accept the diagnoses of his detractors.
Yeah.
And I think to some extent that's what Richard Spencer did when he appeared at Texas A&M a couple of weeks later. He just, it was almost like Hailgate hadn't happened or didn't matter.
Yeah.
He was writing the narrative. And that is an extremely valuable lesson for us to learn, I think, that you shouldn't despair. But at the same time, I think you shouldn't shoot yourself in the foot, which is what Hellgate was, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. I really do think that there was some serious mistakes that need to be learned from, made at MPI. Unfortunately, I think Richard has been the victim of something that wasn't really his fault to a large degree. But his talk at Texas A&M was a good thing, I think. I think that he needed to be back in the public eye, being positive, being proactive, leading from the front again after that fallout.
I agree. I think the sooner it happened, the better, really.
Yeah, I mean, I could offer more critical analysis of this, but I don't want to be too negative about it. And there's always a degree to which this is such new territory. Richard is really riding the tiger. full respect to him for that.
Oh yeah, I mean, this is one.
I'm not sure I want to ride the same tiger, but it's like one of those things where I'm fascinated as to I'm fascinated to see the result of this tiger riding.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, exactly, because you could negatively criticize and analyze this in a sort of despairing manner and think of all the possible fallout. But then that it's one of those things where you might just make that happen by going on about it. And so maybe the better thing to do is just keep going and see what happens. But what I would say is that we should learn the lesson not to put ourselves in this position again of not knowing what the fuck is going on, because it's not good for us.
Yeah, I think that the results from NPI with the media shitstorm showed that we were not in control of what was happening around us there. We were being used by the media, whereas we should have been using the media.
I completely agree. I did an interview and some people told me not to do it. And I thought, well, you see, I was heading into this position where I said this to the journalist. I said, I know that older journalists are fossilized and they just want to demonize us, but I get a feeling that younger journalists are more open-minded because they are more keyed into the zeitgeist, if you like. And you young journalists probably understand that you are going to have to deal with us in the alt-right, one way or the other. So it'd be better if we had a good working relationship instead of you just printing shit about us and us, making fun of you and deriding you. That was what I said to this journalist. Mm. And then he filmed me eating and put out the most contentious parts of a 30-minute, I don't know how long it was, maybe longer than that. And then the clip he included was just out of the blue, me saying that women shouldn't have the vote, and it was a particularly animated part of that video. I mean, it's like a 30, 40-minute video, and I laid out the case calmly, and then at the end, I was sort of, it was all coalescing in my head, so I was kind of excited. But the way when you see that out of context, you think, well, I mean, I just seem crazy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, well, I had the same thing because I did an interview with a Guardian journalist at MPI, and he sort of said to me, he asked me a loaded question. So, do you think all these non-white people should just deport themselves, or should they be deported? And I said, no, I don't think that's necessary. I believe in nationalism is a good thing for everybody. And if I think it's a good thing for my people, it's a good thing for Indians and other people. And I think that over time, that people will seek that value, and that they will gradually gravitate back to the places where they feel they can actualize their own cultural and genetic potentials. And I made this really nuanced, sort of quite sophisticated point. And then he wrote in the Guardian that I said that they just need to self-deport. So it was completely pointless.
Oh.
My attempt at being sophisticated and interesting. He just wrote what he said.
Yeah.
Just put it in my mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. And another thing that they did with me was they include, I mean, again, this was about, I think it was 30. It's all a blur now. It could have been as long as an hour, this interview. And another bit that they chose to include was me saying that I was I started it when I was on welfare and depressed. Well, I mean, thanks very fucking much. You know, what are the public going to think when they? And I know you could say, well, you shouldn't have said it, but I said it in amidst masses of quite complex argumentation. So this isn't exactly. I'm just sort of illustrating. It is frustrating because this is you learn the hard way that these people with whom you can feel you're getting along well will later stab you in the back anyway.
Yeah, they
and,
will.
You know, this is what you were saying, that they were exploiting us. We were not exploiting them. And I didn't even want an exploitative relationship. I was quite naive, and I thought, well, we need a symbiotic relationship of some kind. We need to be on good terms. And but I think I was probably jumping about 5 or 10 years ahead there with that thinking, because we don't have the strength of numbers to withstand their betrayal of such an agreement. So yeah. they're free to just fuck us over, and that's what they did.
Yeah, I think we need to assume what we should already know by instinct anyway, and that is that they are there to exploit us and to screw us over. And they're willing to lie flagrantly. The only reason that we should be engaged with the mainstream media is when we have a very, very specific and well thought out way of using them, not the other way around. So I think we need to stop learning from our own mistakes, start learning from other people's mistakes who've made those mistakes before us. I think there needs to be a lot more coaching as well. Like we used to have these summer schools for people in the BNP where we'd get given media training and logistical training and all kinds of things, which were of immense value to me and other people as well. And I think that we need some of that. We can't afford to be constantly making the same mistakes over and over again when we should know better. Well, certainly those around us who are older and wiser should be making sure that we aren't falling into the same traps that they fell into.
Absolutely. Okay, well, that is a really interesting discussion on Heilgate, I think. So you wanted to talk about your hopes for 2017 with regard to the alt-right.
Yeah, well, I suppose the thing that I wanted to end on was that I'm at a bit of a crossroads in terms of the projects that I am contributing towards. I'm planning on starting my own YouTube channel, which I unfortunately can't cite right now, so anyone can come and look me up. But it will be under my own name, so it will be under the name Matt Tate. It will be on YouTube. And what I really want to do is to cultivate people who are ambitious and have a lot of talent, and I want to be helping people to pick up some of this media training and other things. Whatever I'm doing, I tend to think of myself being on Question Time or being on one of these interviews with a very aggressive media interviewer. And you know, I'd love to go through and analyze other people's interviews that are available on YouTube and to critique them and see where they went wrong and see what I would have done differently and what might be the ideal answers for those particular situations, and also pick out the things that people have done that have been good. And to try and remember those things. So I want to create a channel that attracts people who are in our sphere, who are sort of milling around, maybe some people who are listening, but people who believe that they have a future that is offline, if you like, that they want to be involved in the future in some way, in a way that isn't online, that they want to talk to real people and be involved in community activism.
Right. Okay. Well, when you launch that channel, you and I should do a hangout to advertise it, I think.
Yeah, definitely. That would be much appreciated.
Okay. Excellent. Well, I guess that's everything we're going to talk about. So do you want to wrap it up here, or is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I don't think there's anything else really, but praise be to Keck, and let's hope that 2017 is as exciting and as productive as 2016 has been, and that things keep going our way.
Excellent. Absolutely. Okay, well, thank you, Matt Tate, and thank you to everyone for listening. Next up is Erkenbrand. See you later.